and he healed them. He came to them in the temple and he healed them. But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, and the children that were crying in the temple and saying, "Hosanna to the Son of David," they were moved with indignation. And of course, it's their desire then to destroy Jesus or to crucify him. But I want to call your attention once again to this little expression in verse 13, where he comes into the temple and he sees them buying and selling, and he said, "My house shall be called the house of prayer, but ye make it a den of robbers." He's in the temple. It was to be a special place. It was to be a place of worship, a place of prayer, a place where sacrifices were to be offered, as it were. And now they are just buying and selling in the temple, turned it into a place of merchandise. That's Matthew 21, verse 13. And then the lame and the sick and sick folks came to him, and he healed them. Now, how could you deny his claims when you see the evidence presented through the miracles that he did? Very interesting to me that yet some became jealous and wanted to kill him. But as you continue into the 21st chapter, we emphasize this point that he told a story of a certain householder, landholder. And what did he do?
What did he do?
He went out the fields.
That's right. And what did he expect in time of harvest? All right, he expected to receive the fruits of the vineyard. Instead, what did they do when he sent servant after servant? They killed the servants, and he said, "This is my son, I'll send my son." They'll say, what'd they say? Or they'll kill him. And that's, of course, what they did. And in the context of Matthew 21, beginning there at verse 44, what did they perceive that Jesus was talking about? Him. That's right. He's the Son. And the prophets were the servants that were sent one and another and another and another. And it was their desire then to kill the Son. And in the 22nd chapter, we noted that there were questions that were asked of Jesus. The design of those questions in chapter 22 was to do what?
Trick him into condemning himself.
All right. All right, that's what they desired to do. But he answered their questions in such a way they could not reply. In fact, you'll note, beginning in verse 46, "And no one was able to answer him a word, neither does any man from that day forth ask him any more questions." And then in chapter 23, if I were to ask you to summarize that chapter, what would you label it with? Chapter 23. The whole chapter, for the most part. Hypocrisy. That's right. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." And he referred to them as hypocrites time and time and time and time again. What is a hypocrite, Bruce?
Well, it's one who pretends to be something that he's not. It's an actor.
All right. He pretends to be something that he is not. These scribes and Pharisees. The scribes were those who made copies of the law. You'd think they'd be knowledgeable, and certainly they were identified as the teachers of the law. The Pharisees, who were they? Bruce?
They were the strictest.
The strictest group of the Jews. And they thought that they were so strict that they would make laws where God had not made laws just to make sure they did not break the law of God. And so Jesus called them hypocrites. Now beginning at verse 29 is where I want to back up and come forward of chapter 23, verse 29. It says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye build the sepulchres of the prophets and garnish the tombs of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we should not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye witness to yourselves that ye are sons of them that slew the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers, ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers. how shall ye escape the judgment of hell? Therefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them shall ye kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of Abel the righteous unto the blood of Zechariah, son of Barachiah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. I keep reading, verse 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets, and stoneth them that are sent unto her, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Now you remember that through their history, what had they done to the prophets?
Killed them.
That's right. And now what is it their intention to do to God's Son? Kill him too. That's right. And Jesus says that the wrath of God is going to come upon you, upon this generation. Now that's very crucial that we see that. Sometimes the word generation is perceived or interpreted to be an age of time without necessarily any limitations placed upon it. But yet we find that the term generation is used frequently in the scriptures to talk about the life of a man. And a generation, when we think of a generation, how do you think of it?
30 years.
About so. You know, we're looking at certainly less than 100 years. And Jesus said these things that he's speaking of are going to come upon this generation. That is the generation that he's speaking to at that time in the city of Jerusalem. Notice also, if you would, in verse 38, he says, Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. What's the word desolate mean? Some of you may be using a translation that uses a different word there. What does it mean to be desolate?
Empty.
Or?
Nothing waste.
All right, nothing waste. Okay, that's the idea. Now, when he uses the expression, your house, what's he referring to? The temple. That's right. Your house. You'll note in Matthew 21, as we read, he refers to it as my house. But now he refers to it as your house. And the reason we know that he's making reference to the temple is the next two verses. If you'll drop on down into chapter 24, read verses 1 and 2. And Jesus went out from the temple and was going on his way, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. And he answered and said unto them, See ye not all these? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now, obviously, Jesus is referring to that which would be left desolate. The temple. He was just in the temple, and now he's just come out of the temple, and he's telling these folks that the temple is going to be destroyed. The day is going to come when one stone will not be left upon another. That's pretty desolate, isn't it?
In this generation.
In this generation, he says. You're going to see that. It's going to happen in your generation. Now, the disciples are very much concerned about that. In chapter 24, verse 3, he sat down on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples came to him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, if this had been the religion of your forefathers for the past 1,500 years, and now here's somebody telling you the temple is going to be destroyed, what would you associate that with? It would be the end of the world to you. And notice, if you will, the questions, plural, that they've asked Jesus. I'm convinced that they perceive that it's one question, but Jesus answers it as two questions. The first question, tell us when shall these things be? When shall what be? The destruction of the temple, when one stone will not be left upon another. And he begins to elaborate on that in verse 4. He answered and said, Take heed that no man lead you astray, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and shall lead many astray. Ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for these things must needs come to pass, but the end is not yet. The end of what? All right, the end of that generation, or in particular, the end of the temple and temple service and that kind of thing, that's not a sign of anything. That is, when he mentions wars and rumors of wars. And we talked about that Sunday morning in the class. You hear that all the time. Folks say, well, we must be near the end of time because all you hear about is wars and rumors of wars. Well, you read back through history. That's all you've ever heard about, isn't it? Wars and rumors of wars. That is a sign of absolutely nothing. Jesus said, it's not a sign of the destruction of the temple. It's not a sign of the end of the world. It's not a sign of anything. And furthermore, in verse 8, but all these are the beginning of travail. Then shall they deliver you up to tribulation and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all the nations for my name's sake. Then shall many stumble and shall deliver up one another and shall hate one another, and many false prophets shall arise and shall lead many astray. And because iniquity shall be multiplied, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that endureth to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom, which gospel of the kingdom shall be preached, rather, in the whole world for a testimony unto all the nations, and then cometh, or then shall the end come. Now again, what end is he talking about? The end of the world?
The end of Jerusalem.
The end of Jerusalem. That's right. And he's identified some things here that are not signs at all. They're not signs of anything. And then he's identified some conditions that will exist that are somewhat signs of the fall or the coming fall of the destruction or the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, in our last study, I really lament that we ran out of time. In verse 15, it says, when therefore ye see the abomination of desolation which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let him that readeth understand. Then let them that are in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him that is on the housetop not go down to take out the things that are in his house. And let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. But woe unto them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days. And pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on a Sabbath. And then, or for then, shall be great tribulation, such as hath not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, nor ever shall be. In our study Sunday morning, we talked about this abomination of desolation that Daniel was speaking of. And we noted that parallel accounts also talk about when you see certain things, then you're to flee into the mountains. Don't go down to your house. And if you're in the field, don't go home, and so forth. And it's appropriate that we identify what is the abomination of desolation that Daniel was speaking of. Now, I have, and you have too, heard folks talk about that all through the years, that you see that's some kind of a confederacy of Russia, and they start naming off countries that are going to combine their powers, and that becomes the abomination of desolation that is going to precede the second coming of Christ. Anybody ever heard that?
Yes. All the time.
Not so. The Bible tells us about the abomination of desolation and identifies what it is in the parallel accounts. If you'll note, and we did in Luke 21, verses 20 through 24, and also in Luke 19, verses 41 through 44. And I simply want to call your attention to Luke 21, verses 20 through 24. Juan, do you have that for me, please?
20 through
24? Yes, Luke 21, 20 through 24.
But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled.
All right. Notice that the word desolation is used there in Luke. And notice that the city is named the city of Jerusalem. Notice that the illustrations that are given are the same that we're reading about here in Matthew chapter 24. I suggest to you they're talking about the same thing. In both passages, it's a parallel account of the same thing. Now, when you look in Matthew 24, and he talks about when you see the abomination of desolation, how did Luke record that? When you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel, standing in the holy place, then what are you to do? You're to flee. Now, what was the abomination of desolation? Well, no, that's what it's about.
Jerusalem surrounded by armies.
All right, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you know that the abomination of desolation is the Roman army, or is the army that's about to destroy the city. Then what do? You run. You run to the mountains. You pray that you're not with child. You pray that it's not in the wintertime. And you pray that you're not with a young baby. Why?
It's
going to be hard to run for your life if it's in the wintertime. It's going to be tough to get out of the city. Yeah, no supplies. On the Sabbath day, because the Sabbath day, the gates are closed. And with a young child, how are you going to survive in the mountains with a baby? And so here's the difficulty. You pray that it's not during that time. But you flee the city. You run to the mountains. Now, question. If Jesus is talking about the second coming of Christ, by the use of this term, when you see the abomination of desolation, where are you going to run? What good is the mountain going to do you? Your answer is appropriate. Yeah.
You're saying if you were talking about the end of the world.
Yeah, if he's talking about the end of the world and all this that we've been discussing, if he's talking about the second coming of the Lord and events regarding Russian armies or whatever armies you want to label it with, and we're going to see that right before the coming of the Lord, then where are you going to flee? Well, you say to the mountain. Well, that wouldn't do you any good if it's the second coming of the Lord, would it? Pardon me?
He made
the mountains, yes. They made wintertime in the mountains, too. And made babies, so to speak. So as we talk about those things, fleeing to the mountains is not going to help you escape the second coming of the Lord. But it would help these folks escape the destruction that was coming upon the city of Jerusalem. Do we see that? Now, in verse 19... there's an expression that I want you to note because it's repeated a number of times in the next several verses. And I want to set it in contrast to an expression that occurs in the latter part of this chapter. For example, you'll note in verse 19, "Woe unto them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days." In those days. Notice he's speaking of a plurality of days. Very significant. Furthermore, in those days, verse 22, except those days had been shortened, no flesh would have been saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. And then in verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be darkened and the moon shall not give her light, and so forth. And I want to talk about those verses in great detail when we get to them. But for now, I want to notice that expression, in those days. What days? Aren't the days of the destruction of Jerusalem. When you look up there and you see the Roman armies, and when you see them in the holy place, which is the temple, then you flee. Because those days are going to be characterized by bad things. And you don't want to be a part of it. Now, let's go back, if you will, to verse 23. He said, "Then if any man shall say unto you, Lo, here is the Christ, or here, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christ and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you beforehand. If therefore they shall say unto you, Behold, he's in the wilderness, go not forth. Behold, he's in the inner chamber, believe it not. For as lightning cometh forth from the east and is seen even unto the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Whosoever, or wheresoever rather, the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together." Several things in those verses. There would be some who would claim that when this was about to happen to this city of Jerusalem, they would say, well, the Christ is here or the Christ is there. Jesus said, don't believe it. Don't go over here. Don't go over there. Where did he tell them to go? Flee to the mountains. That's right. Going over here into the wilderness, what good is that going to do you? Or come into the inner chamber. You go into the temple, what good is that going to do you? You see. I said flee into the mountain. Don't be deceived when false Christs come. And they are spoken of with elaborate words that you need to go here or you need to go there. No, he said believe it not. And then in verse 27, for as the lightning cometh forth from the east and is seen even unto the west, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Let me ask you a question. When you go outside on a stormy night, which we have so frequently around here, and you see a bolt of lightning go all the way across the sky, do you have to have somebody tell you that's what it is? Or let's suppose there's a multitude of people outside, and there are 8 or 10 see that. Or do you think everybody's going to see that? Oh, everybody's going to see that. So you're not going to have somebody come and tell you, here is the Lord, or the Lord's here, or the Lord's there. The point being, everybody's going to see this. It's not going to be something that's done in secret. You won't have to have somebody tell you about it. In fact, regarding even the second coming of the Lord, in Revelation chapter 1, in verse 7, the writer says, every eye shall see him, even those that pierced him. Now, what does that suggest about the second coming of the Lord?
Resurrection.
The resurrection. That's right. They'll see him. So you won't have to have somebody tell you, even regarding the destruction of Jerusalem. He's over here, he's over there. When the Lord comes, you'll know it. Now, in verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, now read carefully with me, the sun shall be darkened and the moon shall not give her light and the stars shall fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send forth his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Well, let me pause just there. You know, sometimes we read these verses and we think, well, the language, it's obviously talking about the second coming of the Lord. In fact, Sunday, as somebody asked me, isn't this passage talking about the second coming of the Lord? Or could not this passage be used to talk about the second coming of the Lord? Now, let's think carefully. Though we look at these terms and identify, yes, these terms are in other passages used to identify the second coming of the Lord. Is that how they are used here? And is that the only way that these terms can be used? Well, the answer to that is no. Now, I'm talking about the second coming of the Lord here, and that's not the only way that this terminology is used in the Scripture. Yes, Chris?
Do we know that it's not the second coming of the Lord because of 29, where talking about those days, plural, so it's not the very end. Talking immediately after the destruction of Jerusalem.
That's right. That is right. He's talking about the temporal destruction of the city of Jerusalem seen in the identification of those days. Now, I want to call your attention to a contrast. In verse 36, he says, but of that day and hour knoweth no one, not even the angels of heaven, neither the Son, but the Father only. Now what's he talking about?
He's talking about heaven and 35.
All right. The things of verse 35. That's right. Heaven and earth shall pass away. My words shall not pass away. But of that day, nobody knows. Don't know when the second coming of the Lord is going to be. But he does identify the times when those days, the destruction of Jerusalem, will be. Now, hold your finger here. Two or three things I want us to review, and hopefully that'll help us just a little bit. In verse 28, he says, "Wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together." The term eagles, I understand, was the emblem of the Romans. It was what was on their banner.
This translation says vultures.
Vultures. I have a footnote that says vultures.
I have a
footnote that says eagles. You have a footnote that says eagles. Yeah. But the language is used even in the Old Testament times as something that would describe a foreign nation. It's used in three Old Testament passages describing the powers of a foreign nation. Eagles. Now, who would the eagles represent here? Well, if that was the Roman emblem, and it's the Roman army that we see Luke describes that's going to be surrounding Jerusalem, then where the eagles would be gathered together, that's where you would expect to find carcasses. Isn't that right? Or vultures gathered together. You've seen them circling around and so forth. Now, the point being is that where you see the Roman emblem, that's where you're going to find destruction, because it's the Romans that's going to destroy the city of Jerusalem. Now, what about this language in verse 29 and following that would characterize the time immediately after the tribulation of those days? The sun being darkened and the moon not giving her light and the stars falling from heaven. You know, there was a time in my life when I read language like that, and all I could think of was the second coming of the Lord. And needless to say, this passage was confusing to me for a lot of reasons. You'll note also in Acts chapter 2, similar language that Peter quotes from Joel chapter 2. And it was Acts chapter 2 that especially gave me some problems. Hold your finger here, and I hope I'm not distracting you too much, but I want to look at that in Acts chapter 2, and we'll come right back here. In Acts chapter 2, notice the language of the Apostle Peter. Peter said, as he quotes the prophecy of the Old Testament prophet Joel, from Joel chapter 2, in a portion of this quotation that we see here in Acts chapter 2, look at verse 19 and 20. Acts 2, 19 and 20. He says, "And I will show wonders in the heaven above and signs on the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the day of the Lord come, that great and notable day." Now, when I looked at this passage, I was asked to write a paper on it. And when I came across these terms about the signs and the blood and the fire and the sun turned to darkness and all that, all I could think of was the second coming of the Lord, and I couldn't place that in this context, because the question that these Jews have asked is regarding the miracles that the apostles are performing here in Acts 2. How can this be? Explain this. "And Peter said, these men are not drunken, as ye have supposed, seeing as it is but the third hour of the day. But this is that which was spoken by the prophet Joel that should come to pass in the last days." And then he begins there, verse 17. Do you see that? The quotation is from Joel chapter 2, and the portion that we read in verses 19 and 20, also from Joel chapter 2. Now, this miraculous manifestation of the Holy Spirit, these speaking in tongues and so forth and so on, Peter said was to occur before that great and notable day. Now, I had already come to the conclusion that the exercise of the spiritual gifts no longer exists. And we could talk about that from 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14, as you guys are very familiar with. But if Peter said this bookend of time, well, it's going to be from now until that great and notable day, if that great and notable day is the end of time, then how would you explain that miracles no longer exist? They would exist all through the ages from Acts chapter 2 to the second coming of Christ. And I was stumped in the writing of my paper. And I went to the teacher that had assigned it, and he said, "Had you ever considered that the language that's used there in Acts chapter 2 and that that great and notable day that's being described might be something other than the second coming of the Lord? I said, no, I haven't considered that. He said, well, maybe you need to consider that. Well, now you know what that means. Back to studying. And you know what I found? I found that the terms that are used in Acts 2, quoted from Joel 2, the terms that are used here in Matthew chapter 24 are also terms that are used a number of places in the Scriptures. And so you have to study the context to find out what it is that they're describing. Now, I want you to hold your finger here at Matthew chapter 24, and just for illustration's sake, turn back to Isaiah chapter 13, Old Testament text. Now, when did Isaiah prophesy?
6, 7.
Okay, probably closer to 7, but in that time range. Needless to say, it was quite a long time before Jesus came. Oh, I'm sorry, Isaiah chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13. And what we want to do is a couple of things. We want to look at verses 10 and 11. And when we look at those verses, it says, "For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. And the sun shall be darkened in its going forth, and the moon shall not cause its light to shine." Now, does that sound just exactly like what we read in Matthew 24? But was Isaiah talking about the second coming of the Lord? No, no, not at all. What was Isaiah talking about? Go back to chapter 13, verse 1, and just bring that thought forward. Yes, Isaiah was talking about the fall of Babylon. But yet he talks about the time when the stars of heaven would not give light, and the sun darkened, and the moon would not shine. But he uses that language in reference to the fall of Babylon. Now, while you're there in Isaiah, turn to the 14th chapter. The 14th chapter. And if you'll note, beginning in verse 4, he says, "That thou shalt take up this parable against the king of Babylon, and say, how hath the oppressor ceased, the golden city ceased. Jehovah hath broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers," and so forth. In verse 12, he says, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O day star, son of morning? How art thou cut down to the ground and didst lay low the nations?" Who's he talking about? Babylon, yeah. The kingdom of Babylon is about to fall. Yeah. And so he uses this same language that we're reading in Matthew 24 to talk about the fall of Babylon. Now, if you'll look over in the book of Ezekiel, one more illustration, then we'll move on. If you'll turn to Ezekiel chapter 32. Ezekiel chapter 32. David and Judy are not here tonight. I was going to pick on David. He was with us in our study of Ezekiel. But in Ezekiel chapter 32, James, verses 7 and 8. Would you read that for me, please?
"I shall extinguish thee, I will cover the heavens, and make the stars thereof dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give its light. All the bright lights of heaven will I make dark over thee, and set darkness upon thy land, saith the Lord Jehovah."
All right, now my question, obviously, is, who's he talking about? Is Ezekiel talking about the second coming of the Lord? No. Who's he talking about? All right, God's judgment upon Egypt. But it's the same kind of language that was used by Isaiah to talk about God's judgment upon Babylon. And I want to suggest to you that it's the same kind of language that's used by the Lord to talk about His judgment upon Jerusalem in our text of Matthew 24. He's not talking about the second coming of the Lord. That's not the context. The context is discussing the city of Jerusalem. Now, granted, similar terminology is used in reference to the second coming of the Lord. For example, in Acts chapter 1, how was Jesus taken up? In the clouds. How did the angels assure that He would return?
Same way.
In the clouds. That's right. Well, that's what we see here. Ye shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. But that's not the thought here in Matthew 24. Though it is in Acts chapter 1.
One of your parallels in Luke said that it was actually God's judgment
upon Jerusalem. Yeah. Upon Jerusalem. Yeah. Pardon me? Oh, till the age of the Gentiles come in. Yeah, that's another thought. That's dealing with the time when all nations would have the privilege of the gospel being preached to them and so forth and so on. But the immediate context there is dealing with the destruction of Jerusalem. I think it's identified in that context, named Jerusalem. There in the passages that I gave, what was it, Luke 20? So he's discussing again the fall of Jerusalem. He's giving a time frame when Jerusalem would fall. Now, as we talked about the angels, the sound of the trumpet, you can read that language in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, can't you? Beginning in verse 13. Somebody have that for me? 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning in verse 13. First Thessalonians 4:13.
Yeah. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren,
all right,
about those who are asleep, so that you will not grieve as you do the rest that you have not hope.
Keep going.
For we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen asleep.
All right, here's our point coming up.
For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, and with the voice of our angel, and with the trumpet of the Lord.
Trump.
By the trumpet of the Lord. And the dead in Christ will rise first, and then we who are alive will be caught up together with him in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so shall we be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words.
All right, in the reading of that, did you see that he comes with the sound of the trumpet and so forth? You got that, didn't you, as Bruce was reading that? Well, no, that's the same language that we're reading here in Matthew 24. But there it's used to apply to the second coming of the Lord. Here it's not. So what we want to see is that the language is not always used to apply to the second coming of the Lord. It's used in reference to temporal judgments. It's also used in this passage and others that we've read to talk about God's judgment on the world when he comes in that last day. Okay? Any question or comment on that? That's a very significant point. I want us to see that. Yes?
Verse 31 of that.
Uh-huh.
I see all the other stuff you pointed out in the other chapters of the Old Testament, but I didn't see anything about the great trumpet and when you gather together, the four winds, the wind, the sky, the other.
Yeah.
I didn't see none of that, the other stuff you went back to.
No, I don't think that those particular terms exist in the Old Testament. The sounding of the trumpet does in Isaiah 61, beginning in verse 1 through verse 3. But I don't think you'll find some of these other terms because the elect didn't exist in the Old Testament. The elect is identifying the church. And, of course, the church hadn't been established yet, not even in Matthew 24. But it would be by the time of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., so I think that's an interesting point. Yeah. Surely not. No, those aren't used in those Old Testament texts. Now, in verse 32, back to Matthew 24, verse 32. Hold up. Yep, hold up, Jenny.
Verse 29, the first word there says immediately. I looked that up to see whether it was ever used figuratively. It's not. Immediately is the same word that's used for how long it took for Jesus to cleanse someone of leprosy,
okay.
How long it took for the disciples to leave their nets and follow Jesus, how long it took for the rooster to crow after Peter had denied Jesus the third time.
Short time.
It's a very short time.
Yeah, short time. So he's not talking about after this, then all this is going to happen, second coming of the Lord. No, that'd be a long time. All right, Karen?
I think he just mentioned 32, but were you done talking to 30 and 31?
Yes, for the most part. Did you have something in particular you wanted to address?
The last time, whenever we discussed, I have a big giant question mark. I still don't understand what is the sign of the Son of Man. How does he gather them together from one end of the sky to the other? How does that fit in with Jerusalem? That's my big question mark.
When you see the Roman army encompassing the city, that's a sign of the Son of Man coming in destruction upon the city of Jerusalem.
In the sky, though?
No.
It says
no,
it
wouldn't necessarily be in the sky.
But that's what it
says. Verse 30 says the same.
Yeah. In verse 30.
On the clouds in the sky.
Yeah.
In the sky.
Yeah. Well, the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. I think the language there is used, again, to describe a temporal judgment. It is so used in Old Testament texts. For example, in Isaiah, look at chapter 19 and read for me verse 1. And Randy, while you're turning to that one, turn also to Psalms. Carol, would you get Isaiah? And Randy, would you get Psalms 19,
no,
verses 2 and 3? Pardon me.
What
oh, I'm sorry. Isaiah 19, verse 1.
And I'm going to Psalms what?
You're going to Psalms 97, verses 2 and 3.
Yeah. 19, what did you say? 19:1. The oracle concerning Egypt. Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. The idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them.
All right, where was judgment coming from?
The,
and upon the, whom?
From the Lord.
Upon?
Upon a cloud to Egypt.
All right. So we see that the judgment of God is described as coming on a cloud. Well, did God's judgment literally come on a cloud? No, that's not the point. The point is, here's the judgment of God. This is how it's described. Now, is the second coming of the Lord described that way too? Yes. Acts 1. But what I want you to see is that temporal judgments, language is used in Scripture, same language. The Lord coming in the clouds. So when we look at that expression, we don't always have to conclude that he's talking about the second coming of the Lord.
What's the difference between the sign of the Son of Man and the Son of Man? Because it uses both in the same...
I don't know that I know the answer to what you've asked.
And
the
then,
distinction between the two.
And then in 31, there's angels and the elect and...
Well, the elect is talking about those who are members of the church. And the angels will gather them from the four winds. Now, that term is used
to talk about all over.
Yeah, like the next expression, from one end of heaven to another. And I think that's how we see it identified in Luke's account there in chapter 13, verse 29, as was read earlier. The elect will be gathered from all over the world.
So, in this passage... We're just talking about Jerusalem?
This passage
are
is talking about the elect in Jerusalem.
That the elect are the ones who are going to survive it?
Yes.
Because they went to the mountains?
Yes. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
Because verse 22 says, unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved.
That's right.
For the sake of the elect, those days have been cut short.
So those are the same.
Yeah. I may be doing a poor job saying it, but that's exactly what I'm trying to say.
Okay, it's been a long day for me.
Yes, exactly. Now, in verse 36. I am, yeah. Verse 34 is the verse. This generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished. Heaven and earth shall not pass away, but my words. Or heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. You can put a mark right there at verse 34 and point an arrow upward. Everything that he's talked about up until that, through verse 34, was going to come to pass upon that generation. That's what he said in chapter 23. That's how he concludes this in verse 34. 97:2-3. I didn't. If you would, real quick.
Psalm 97:2-3. Clouds of thick darkness surround him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. Fire goes before him and burns up his adversaries round about.
Very simply, to make the another application of the passage, that these terms are not always used pertaining to the second coming of the Lord.
Kind of any time there's God's judgment, there's.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You see this picture. Yeah.
Daniel sent it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Daniel 7:13.
One of our spelling words this week is turmoil.
So oh.
I Googled it and up came all sorts of stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, be sure you have your questions done. Hopefully, I'll get to them on Sunday. No comments.
See what
questions on 51.
Don't have those.
Oh.